Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks for joining us here on the program as we jump into a new topic and a new subject every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We also have podcasts that are available on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and many other locations, as well as the homepage of RichardDugan.com and the radio show's page. If this is your first time listening to the program, and we certainly hope that this is your first of many times, we encourage you to go to our missions page to see and hear what we're all about here by virtue of going to the podcasts. And if you like what we're doing, we do have a PayPal and Patreon account. If you'd like to support us in the financial aspects of this broadcast, we are gratefully appreciative for that contribution, for that support, for that energetic support as well. And my thanks to those who have supported and to those who are going to support. As we head into the latter portion of 2019, and hopefully when we hit 2020, we'll have perfect vision of what it is that we want to do with our lives. And part of bringing that to your attention is going to be the return of one of my favorite guests, Miguel Dean, all the way from the UK. And we're going to be talking, of course, if you haven't listened to the previous interview, we're going to be talking about not only his book, Bring Him Home. It is a twin flame love story. We're also going to be talking about another subject that I think is really important, especially nowadays. It's not that it hasn't been important before, but it's kind of come to the forefront. Sacred masculinity. We'll get a lot of information about that and also Miguel Dean's story. Miguel, welcome back to the program, all the way from the UK.
Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you for the invitation. It's really good to be here. It's a beautiful, sunny afternoon here in the UK. So, yeah, it's good to be on board and reconnect with you.
Well, we've got a beautiful, sunny morning here in Santa Barbara, so we're kind of sharing that in that respect. And we certainly hope that people will certainly go to your website, which I'm going to give to the folks right now. We, of course, link to your website. We have with the previous broadcast, the previous interview or podcast, and we'll link with this one as well to migueldean.net. That's migueldean.net, and you are also on Facebook, and people can get copies of your book. There's also a link to read a little from the book, a little excerpt, if you will, on your website. So we encourage people to check that out. Let's we'll jump into your story here in just a moment. What I want, and actually, I think we'll probably be jumping into your story quicker than I think when we jump into this subject, which I think maybe we'll spend a good portion of the program talking about, and that's this concept, this aspect, or this philosophy of sacred masculinity. You know, there are those who are putting masculinity at the end of other phrases like toxic and, you know, and all of these types of things that have existed for centuries because men have sort of been, and I'm going to say allegedly in control and calling the shots for centuries. What I find so beautiful is the stories of women who have contributed to the growth of our civilizations and societies over the centuries. I have to tell you how affirming as a man that is, that thank goodness there were women who were helping us. You know, we weren't alone, you know, kind of thing. But let's talk about this aspect of sacred masculinity. First of all, what is it?
Okay, thank you, Richard. Yeah, I like this line that without the sacred, all masculinity is incomplete. Now, what I mean by that is that the sacred is the aspect that understands that we are not just separate human beings that have the beginning is birth and the end is death, and that's the end of the story. The sacred is a recognition that there is an immortal and eternal aspect to us, our consciousness, our divinity, our connection with God or with Source, whatever you want to call it. So the sacred masculine is somebody who recognizes this. And for me, that is a real prerequisite to any masculinity, because when we're coming from that place, there's a total shift in the way that we view our lives and we view our purpose and we view the world, really. And it's coming from this collective unified place rather than the place of separation and ego and competition from which a lot of other masculinity arises. So the sacred masculine is really, somebody who encompasses, who understands that what we perceive with our senses is just the tip of the iceberg, that what we can comprehend with our minds is, again, just perhaps a small puddle. And, out beyond that, when we really tap into source and come back to this place of union rather than separation, there are possibilities that we can't even imagine at the moment, and a clearer understanding of what actually is really going on.
And that's kind of the key too. And I know a lot of people are, both men and women, are concerned about, especially the rising up of these different movements here in the last few years, especially here in the States, the Me Too movement, to name one. And the reason I say that is because there are a lot of, in a conversation I had several months ago with a woman talking about these very subjects from the female side of it, the feminine side, I said there are a lot of men walking around, they're scared because they're afraid to look the wrong way at a woman for being accused of something, to which she said with great energy and attitude, "Welcome to the club." And I thought, wow, okay, I get it. Okay, but don't attack me. That's kind of how I felt a little bit, but I know where that's coming from. I have four sisters. I haven't really talked to them about this particular subject as of yet, and maybe that'll come up. But the women are, of course, walking around scared because they don't know what the men are going to do, if they're going to get attacked or what have you. But the men are just as afraid of women because they don't know, as I say, if you look at them the wrong way, if they aren't going to accuse you of some crime or some misdemeanor, so to speak. And we have to come to a place of balance, don't we? I mean, there's the sacred feminine, which is obviously part of the whole. And isn't that kind of what we have lost, is the connection between the two? That it isn't the masculine or the feminine, it's the two of them combined, and that they've been separated for so long, if you will, in our societies. I think that a lot of people, the part of the fear is that they don't know what to expect when the energies are combined.
Yeah. There's loads of interesting points that you raise there, Richard. And I totally agree that, what we're aspiring for now is union and balance. It's, it's perfectly and beautifully illustrated by the yin-yang symbol, the complementary opposites. But it seems as if, the pendulum, when it swings to one extreme, as it has done with patriarchy, with men being, in inverted commas, control, and then, and the denigration and of the feminine principles and woman herself, then, it's kind of natural that when something like the Me Too movement comes up and women are given a voice and there is some recognition of what they have had to suffer and put up with for probably generations, then it becomes a sort of mouthpiece for a lot of anger and pain and grief and suffering that has been suppressed in the lineage, if you like, for generations. But we have to come to this point where we lay down our weapons and we say, as you alluded to, Richard, that men have been wounded too. The rates of male suicides goes up and up and up. Men's mental health, connected to the whole big boys don't cry and that we're not supposed to show emotions and all that nonsense. So, you know, there's massive wounding, and women use their sexuality, you know, in toxic ways as well. And men have invited that to a certain extent. And it's kind of like it's all got in such a mess that it seems to me that the only solution is that we move forward from a place of forgiveness and laying down the weapons and say, look, we all got terribly lost and we've wronged each other. But we need to, you know, we need a blank piece of paper. We need a fresh start, and we need to put the past behind us and say, okay, so how do we do it from here? You know, how do we move forward from here? And my understanding is that, you know, the sacred masculinity is, you know, is a part of that. And the same as is the, you know, sacred feminine is a part of that as well.
Yeah. Now, it's rather interesting, the dichotomy between the United States and the UK specifically, since that's where you are and this is where I am, that the UK, the British Isles, has had over the decades in particular, in its government, as the head of the government, both men and women. You know, people will remember, of course, Margaret Thatcher as prime minister, obviously Winston Churchill going back many years. And, of course, recently Theresa May. And, of course, now you have Boris Johnson, you know, and so forth. And it's only been 10 years since we elected our first, you know, this is what kept coming up during the after the election of Barack Obama. We've only stepped out of the color mold once in our history, electing the first black president. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know what? And setting all politics aside, it doesn't matter who's in the office today. You know, maybe we need a woman. We need a woman's touch, I think, to see how things will be. And it's not to say that necessarily women are going to do it better than men or worse than, although from my personal perspective, I don't think they could do any worse. And certainly it's gratifying for us to see women in our legislative body. I haven't really taken a look at the makeup of your legislative body in the UK. But when I see some of the clips of the Prime Minister addressing Parliament, the voices are mostly male voices. I don't know if there are many women serving in Parliament other than as Prime Minister, per se. But that's just my own lack of observation, probably. Do you see, in your experience, with the people that you work with, and of course you do work individually with folks, you do a certain level of counseling or consult, if you will, working with people to help them to come to a place of either, of greater understanding of the dynamic, but also of themselves as men in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I call them sacred masculine healing sessions, and they are all about, you know, the inner union of the masculine and feminine principles within men and women. I'm actually working more with women at the moment. And the majority of women that are coming to me have come with pretty sad and painful stories of how they've been let down by men and abused and so on. And so they come for a positive experience of what it is to be held by a clear, clean kind of masculine energy, which is the sacred masculine energy, which is the energy which enables one to unfold and relax and open so that things can be healed. So, sacred masculine healing sessions, that's one of the things that I offer. But Richard, I think you were going somewhere else with this.
Well, I actually am going in a direction where several years ago, we had a gentleman who came to town, a rather famous individual, in the men's movement, if you will, or at least in terms of a form of sacred masculinity. And I had a men's group back in 1993, and the primer, if you will, the book that we used was from this particular author, whose name is Robert Bly. Yes. And we were using the book Iron John. I actually want to have you touch upon the comparisons between Robert Bly's work and yours. But we used that primer, if you will, and then the three of us, there were only three of us in the men's group. I, at the time, was the only married guy. And we would go on hikes in the mountains around the Phoenix area, mm-hmm. which were fabulous. We would sit and talk. We'd have a little campfire and talk about the stuff that was going on. And that really seemed to release some of the energy. Maybe not so much the frustration, although when that energy is released, the frustration doesn't seem quite as severe. And it really seemed to help. Have you found that those kinds of gatherings for men, and then in turn, women's gatherings for women, are a necessary as well as beneficial part of, we need to be incorporating that into our society and into our social structure? Or are we so far beyond that folks can't feel that that's a safe space for them to kind of let this stuff out? Because especially with the problems we're having on the internet and the social media with bullying and the accusations of this, that, and the other thing. What are your thoughts about men's and women's groups and being able to share openly, honestly, and feeling safe to do so?
Yeah, I think it's pretty essential. I think it's pretty essential that there is a space, you know, a safe space for men to gather and for women to gather. The key really is who is holding the space and how safe it is. And it's a very skillful, skill to be able to hold the space and to be able to allow a certain amount of release and venting and people to speak their truth, but you know, to be that it's done in an honorable way. Because the danger is, and I've come across this in some of the events and organizations that I've become involved with in my work, is that they, you know, a woman's group can become just an opportunity to be for man bashing, and you know, and the same for men. It's kind of like, oh, you know, I'm just confused by women, I just don't get them. And it's kind of like it can become quite derogatory. So, I think it needs to be held really well. And I think ideally there's a space for men on their own, women on their own. And then there's a space, a celebration space for men and women to come together and do the work as well and celebrate their differences and not feel threatened by the differences. So, you know, I think if we look at indigenous peoples, I think the majority of the indigenous peoples, which are, you know, often were quite successful in the way that their the health of their societies and communities and until the white man came along, as it were. But, that they often had space. The women would do certain things together, and there was rites of passage for the boys that would hang out with the men, and there will be times for the coming together. So I think there is certainly a need for that. And I think it would be very valuable in, you know, helping to heal the wounds that have accumulated over the generations. But yeah, my concern is that it needs to be really skillfully, you know, and delicately managed so that it doesn't become something that creates even more division and, you know, between the sexes.
Yeah, I know that is certainly a huge concern on the part of a lot of folks because it's like it's something that we need. And I know that there are communities, small communities around this country as well as around the world that are being developed and they are making them safe spaces and they are allowing the individuals to really share. I don't know about you, but in the 80s and 90s, I participated in quite a number of personal growth and development programs, starting with one in 1980 called LifeSpring. And apparently it was a sort of a spinoff of sorts from EST that was in here in California. But I, of course, I was in Arizona and they were holding those kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. And I remember a quote or a phrase that was made to the group collectively on the first evening of one of these gatherings, where, you know, they would address the issue of feeling uncomfortable and how people would think, oh, I really don't want to be here, you know, I you know, so on and so forth. And so the person, the facilitator, would basically say, you're probably thinking and feeling like you really don't want to be here. Well, let me explain something to you. If you didn't want to be here, you wouldn't be. However, you are here, so that means that you must want to be here. And so logic dictated that, you know, you couldn't argue with the facilitator because you're sitting right there in the chair in the group. And so, you know, and of course, the facilitator is encouraging people to participate, to get involved, not just in the program, but get involved in their own lives. Do you find that people that you work with, they're not really fully involved in and participating in their own lives? That's part of the disconnect, that they're just going through the motions. They're almost half asleep or even sleepwalking. And so they're easily suggestible to go this direction or that direction, rather than searching out and finding, as we like to talk about on this program, their life's purpose and fulfilling that, and then feeling fulfilled and feeling at peace inside.
Yeah, I think we live to a, I think to a large extent, our society disempowers the individual. I think there's, you know, there's perhaps a slightly sinister energy behind that, but we don't need to go into that. But it's like, you know, if you're ill, then you go to the doctor to fix you. If you've got, you know, whatever problem it is, whatever it is that you need doing, there's somebody else that's an expert that we give our money to in exchange for them sorting out the problem. And I think that happens an awful lot as well with our own personal growth and our own personal development, or, you know, spiritual development. So I do get people, you know, especially in the kind of new agey movement, there is still this desire, and I see it in me sometimes. It's like, I just want somebody to fix this problem that I've got, or this wound that, you know, that is healing, or this old energy that is coming up to be cleared. It's like, this is really uncomfortable. And if somebody said to me, you know, well, if you give me, you know, £80 for a session, I will guarantee that it's gone, then, you know, you would gladly pay the money. But there's a lot of that. It seems to me that facilitators, you know, and healers, that's what they're doing. They're just making the healing process a bit easier. You know, they're lubricating the process to make it smoother. But we have to do the work. Yeah, the individual has to go to do the work, and the individual has to be okay with not being okay, you know, to going to uncomfortable places and so on. So I think there is an element of, yeah, quite often that people come and they think that you've got a magic wand, and that, you know, you're going to make it all better. And, you know, they're sort of half-heartedly involved sometimes when they find that magic wand isn't there. It's like, okay, well, you know, that was lovely, but see you later. Whereas others do sort of go, oh, okay, I really get this. And you know, and then they jump in fully.
What is the core message that you would have others who are listening get in reference to sacred masculinity?
Well, I think sacred masculinity is a potential for everybody. If people, you know, if you're a man, you know, there is the sacred feminine, so, you know, that which is the female counterpart. But if we're talking about men, I mean, what happened for me, you see, Richard, was I stumbled across it. It wasn't like at some point I set out and sort of thought, okay, I'm going to, you know, walk the path of the sacred masculine. It was, I was intent on healing my own wounds and finding some peace within myself from the, you know, from the things that had happened to me as a child when I was growing up and so on. But I quickly discovered that I couldn't do this in isolation. And that actually, the more I helped others and the more that I was of service, the more it facilitated the healing of my own inner wounds. And the more that my inner wounds healed, the more powerful my impact in service to the collective and others was. So, you know, I guess my message, the core message really of the Sacred Masculine is that the Sacred Masculine, because he knows that everything is connected and that there is a bigger picture and that what we perceive with our senses is just the tip of the iceberg, he is always looking for opportunities to serve and to help others, knowing that this is a way of helping and serving himself, but in a clean way, you know, because again, there's this fine line of discernment that you can get people that are put all their energy into helping others and they're very nice people, but it's at the expense of themselves because they have low self-worth and they need this constant external validation and this feedback that they are a good person because they've rescued somebody else. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does. And it sounds to me like those individuals are going to either be very self-deprecating. They're going to be constantly putting themselves down. And you can hear and feel the lack of confidence that they have in themselves. Or they will go to the other extreme and they will build themselves up bigger than life, so to speak. And the ego and the all of that stuff. I mean, we would even label that to the extreme narcissism, to where you sit there and go, wow, what is it that, you know, what are you covering up that you have to embellish so much about yourself? And so we have those two extremes, and we need to find that space in the middle. Where we can reside and begin that process of finding who we are. And that seems to be the key message from a lot of our guests, is the real key that we need to find to unlock our potential, if you will, is we've got to know ourselves. We've got to get to know ourselves. We've all heard that phrase, know thyself, or to thine own self be true. And I don't know whether that's Shakespeare or or where it comes from. All I know is it's a pretty popular quote. We're talking with Miguel Dean. He is the author of a book we're going to get into, Bring Him Home, A Twin Flame Love Story. And I do have to say that the excerpt that you have available, chapters 1 and 2 on your website, people can go to and read at least the first two chapters to get sucked in, to get drawn into the story. It's a great story. It really is. It does remind me, when we talked the last time we got together back in August of 2019, it reminded me of the movie The Butcher's Wife. And it was quite extraordinary, especially when they came up, they created that phrase, the split aparts, that was one of the phrases that was used. And even my wife and I, we kind of felt that we were two individuals who had been split apart somewhere along the way throughout the course of eternity. And we found each other in this lifetime kind of thing, and kind of working together to do the things that we're doing, to seek out our life's purpose, to dive into spiritual concepts and philosophies, and, of course, this radio program as well. So I encourage you to go to migueldean.com. I beg your pardon. That's migueldean.net. Migueldean.net. And find out more, migueldean.net. We will be linked to your website. And Miguel, we're going to come back and we're going to continue our conversation here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay right where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
You know, I think about the song that plays going into each of these segments, the theme that we've been using for over 13 years, the phrase there that you hear right at the end, I'll do my best to understand you. And it seems to me, Miguel, that the phrase, I'll do my best to understand you, needs to be pointed at self. Because as I alluded to in the last segment, at the end of the last segment, that unless we start going inward, we are never going to really be able to work within the outer world at some level, of peace. Is that a fair assessment?
I would say that's a pretty fair assessment, Richard. Yeah. It's, you know, the world that we live in teaches us to look outside, doesn't it, for solutions, for happiness. You know, if I get this car or I get this job or this girlfriend or this holiday or, you know, this status or, you know, this house, it promises, you know, happiness and peace in this way and contentment. But we know, you know, that it's actually happiness and peace is always an inside job. So we have to start getting to know ourselves. Yeah, that was what happened for me, you know, in my late 20s. It began the journey of, okay, I need to understand myself. I need to understand what's going on in order to shed that which I don't want to carry anymore. So, yeah, you know, we really have to start doing the work and understanding ourselves. I think I would stick my neck out and say, yeah, you know, we can only understand others to the extent to which we understand ourselves.
Isn't that the truth? And right now, at least here in the United States, I only have glimpses through Sky TV, Sky News, of what you're going through there in terms of this whole aspect of dividing things up. I know you folks, gosh, you guys have been going through for almost as long, if not longer, this whole issue of Brexit and leaving the European Union that we've had with our current president. And it's like, okay, we see what's going on. We see the people who are making the decisions, or at least, you know, trying to and so forth. But one of the things that I've come to realize is that stuff doesn't really matter. That's really kind of irrelevant, isn't it? I mean, it's like, yeah, you could get wrapped up, and a lot of people do, and they'll go out and protest, and they'll do this, that, and the other thing. And I just sit there going, what's this accomplishing? Yeah, okay, you need to speak your mind and say, get your voice out there and everything. I understand that as an individual. But how is this helping our society? What are your thoughts, not on these specific issues, but in terms of, and I'm not really taking a position either way per se, but your thoughts on these kinds of issues that come up in our respective societies that cause us to want to draw a line in the sand, if you will, or in the case of England, in the peat moss, and say, I'm right and you're wrong, and we need to do this, not that, instead of, again, that whole aspect of going within to better understand why I am even involved in this. Is this really part of my life's purpose? Is this really what I'm supposed to be doing?
Mm. Yeah, it's part of the play of duality, isn't it? You know, this thing of, you know, up and down, right and wrong, you know, this party and that party. And it just seems, you know, it's part of an old story that is crumbling. And I was relieved when you got to a certain point of your comment there, when you know, when you said, does it really matter? Because I don't believe it. For me, the politics seems like a pantomime. It just seems like a performance. It's like if politics was going to bring peace and bring, you know, heaven on earth and create a utopian society, it would have done it ages ago. It's just that it's a toing and froing, and it's a kind of like a distraction from actually what matters. Because, you know, the Native Americans, I remember hearing a story about when some of the tribes came together and said, how should we govern our people? And they said that they, before they would change any laws, before they would make any differences to the way that they were living and governing and so on, they would always look, how will that affect our people in seven generations' time? Now, that's, you know, that in that respect, government, you could see, might actually, you know, have some value and might work. But for 5 years of government office, where there must be billions of pounds must have been spent on this whole Brexit stuff, you know, the bureaucracy and civil servants and this report and that report. And it's like, there's enough there to, you know, money spent on that to feed all the hungry people in the world, probably, you know. It just seems like it's superficial, and it's back to the sacred masculine, that while we're still coming from this place of ego and separation, and a lot of our leaders seem to be little boys in men's bodies, then, you know, then it's just going to be like a pantomime. And you listen to my, you know, our leaders in government, and it sounds like a bun fight at a boarding school. They're all just trying to make, you know, smart ass comments at each other and score points. And I just think, really, you know, is that really who, you know, we've given our power to, and the people that are, you know, calling the shots? So I don't tend to get involved with it, Richard, and I'm actually quite proud of saying I've never voted in my life, because of exactly what I've just said. I just see it as a pantomime, and I just think it's a big charade, and it really will never find solutions until we move into the sacred, and to coming and seeing life as all sacred, and coming from this higher self of consciousness that is within all of us.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really funny too, because if you were to say that as an American in the United States, you run the risk of being tarred and feathered. How dare you not vote? Da, 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 da. And this is my logical response to that attitude, and that is, you say that if I don't vote, then I have no right to complain, to which I say, oh, yes, I do, because I pay their salaries whether I vote for them or not. Mm-hmm. And so the moment that I get to keep all my tax dollars that don't go to their salaries, I'll go over in the corner and you'll never hear another word from me. Another element of that, as you sort of alluded to, is when we talk on this program about seeking out one's life's purpose and about making this world a better place and putting our energies into those aspects of life and living and thriving, when we put our energies into those things that aren't going in the direction of thriving and changing the world for the better for all people, then we are wasting our energy. We are depleting it. We're getting, it's almost like these issues, you've heard of energy vampires as individuals, people who suck your energy dry out of you, you know? Well,
yes.
There are issues that do the same thing, whether it's Brexit, whether it's the leader of your country, whether it's whatever the issues are, they just drain you. And so it's like, I'm not going to waste my energy doing that. I'm going to utilize my energies going in a different direction. And I think maybe that's where we've sort of gone wrong, isn't it? Isn't that we have allowed ourselves, and we have been told, kind of like the individual who would say to you, that you have no right to complain if you're not participating in the process. It's like, well, that may be true on the one level, but at the same time, look at my life. Look what I have accomplished. Look what I have achieved in terms of helping other people, et cetera, et cetera. I have no room to complain, so why should you? I'm doing what I love doing. You, Miguel, are doing what you love to do to make your life a better life today than it was yesterday, and tomorrow a better life than it is today. And again, that's not to say today ain't bad, but also for others, to help lift them up and help to lift up our society and our civilization to raise that consciousness, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think we give our power away to politicians. And, you know, it's always people. If we look back in history, it's always, you know, it's very rarely governments that bring about big shifts and big changes. Mm-hmm. It's the Martin Luther Kings, it's the Gandhis, it's the Emily Pankhursts, it's the William Wilberforce, you know, it's these people, these individuals that have said no. You know, it's almost like you have to break the law, you know, to do things differently, to bring about positive change, because the majority of laws are made to maintain the status quo. And the status quo, we maintain the status quo, and we can see, you know, where the planet is as a result of, you know, consumerism and you know, seeking happiness through material objects and so on, and it's not working and it's not sustainable because the earth has only got a certain amount of resources. So it's like, well, let's look at some other options. But a lot of people, you know, still giving their power away and still thinking that the politicians are going to do it. As I said, you know, initially, I think if they were going to, you know, if there was going to be great change and wonderful things happening, then it would have happened by now if it was down to politics. So what is left but for the people to each say, I have power. If I have power and make choices and I align my life with an internal compass of doing good and truth, then if that, you know, everybody else that starts doing that, then that's how change takes place. You know, that's what will bring about things being done differently.
And things do need to be done differently, and they are. And as you say, it's not from the governmental level that things are changed. It's from the individuals. I mean, we regardless of how one might feel, per se, about, say, the Me Too movement or whatever. And I'll be honest with you, I sometimes do tend to look at protests as almost at one level, they're sort of a waste of energy. I mean, my goodness, I understand individuals, you know, who are willing to die for their beliefs. But if you die, what good are you now? What good are you to the belief that you held that you wanted things differently? And it just seems to me like you're right. It is I want to say the little people who are actually the big people. I'll put it into business terms, Miguel. In a multi-billion dollar corporation, who is the one or who are the ones who actually have made the billions of dollars? Is it the guy at the top, the CEO? I don't think so. Although people will argue that he made this decision and that. It's the people, if you will, at the bottom. It's the workers. It's those who have come in contact with the consumer, if you will, or the general public who are purchasing the product or service from that multi-billion dollar corporation that made the billions. And they don't get the credit that they so richly deserve. Case in point, I had a problem with my Amazon account. And I called Amazon 4 times in 2 days. 4 times. Mm-hmm. And they finally, and again, the problem was not on my end. They resolved it without getting any personal information from me, without me having to re-enter anything. And it was so frustrating. I mean, I certainly was relieved when it was over and I got everything back to normal. But it's like, what's going on? I didn't do anything to affect this change, and yet nobody is calling me back. Nobody is sending me emails telling me what the problem is and how to solve it. And I have to give a little bit of credit to the last person that I spoke with, because that person was the one that resolved the issue. Thank you very much. But it wasn't, I can't even remember the guy's name who, I know he's been in the news a lot and just was recently divorced, I guess. But he's not the one that did that. This individual on the phone who spoke to me, and each one of the people I did speak with, they were kind and they did the best that they could. And they said, we'll pass this on to the right department and everything. But I think that's one of the things that we forget. And that also that these multi-billion dollar corporations forget. That it's not the people who are sitting up in the penthouse that made this building where the penthouse sits. They didn't do it. It was on the, if you will, on the backs of others. And that's, to me, where the power is. It's in the people, you and me.
Yeah, I agree totally. I agree totally. I mean, I guess, you know, sometimes we need the captain of the ship and so on. But it's, I think, you know, the separation, the difference, that everybody should be getting paid a similar kind of wage and similar amount of credit for the, you know, for the success of the company. But to rewind a little bit, something that you just said just previously, Richard, mm-hmm. about the protesting, and I think that's a really interesting point, because I'm similar to you in that I don't choose to put my energy into protesting about what is not right, or you know, bringing attention to that. But I choose to put my energy into the solutions and just keeping my head down and, you know, and doing my thing. What seems to be my mission around the, you know, the union of the masculine and feminine. But I think what was I going to say? I've lost my train of thought.
Well, we were, of course, talking about the whole aspect of protesting and putting our energies into those things that are actually going to make a real difference, although there will be those who will argue that some of the protests, for example, the civil rights protests of the 60s and 70s, supposedly made a difference. And yet I sit here and I hear, coming from our legislative body, or I hear, we're now going to renew the 1965 Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act of 1970, this or that or that. I'm going, what do you mean renew? That should have been in perpetuity. That should have been forever. How is it that something like that, see, that is like, really? The protests made that much of a difference that they put an expiration date on it and it has to be renewed every so many years? That's just ridiculous. I don't get it. But again, this is, I don't want to go too much further down this little rabbit hole, but I thought it was important to talk about, because men in particular, get drawn down these rabbit holes. And by the way, someone said to me not too long ago, to dovetail off of your comment about politics, it's the best theater that money can buy, and i.e. through your taxes. And so now, when I see and or hear stuff going on in the news about politics, I will put a laugh track behind it. I'll put a little theme music or something behind it. And I'll just say, it's just theater. All the world's a stage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it just kind of takes the sting out of it. It's like, this really isn't. I mean, Miguel, wouldn't you say that from the cosmological perspective, all of this stuff that's going on here is irrelevant, and the universe as at large doesn't really care.
Yeah. I agree totally. It's kind of, it's like another form of entertainment, another X factor. I mean, we know that the big shots and the big decisions, and that to a certain extent, governments are puppets for the big CEOs and the big multinationals and so on, the big money makes the moves and makes the decisions. But what I wanted to say, I remember what I wanted to say, and that was about the protest stuff and the difference between, you see, I think there's a big difference between the energy to which you bring to something. So if you're going to, and everything arises from either love or fear. And I think there's a lot of protesting and a lot of stuff going on in the world that is fear-based, fear that, you know, that the planet's going to be destroyed and that, you know, that we're not going to be able to, you know, that there's going to be massive disasters and all this sort of stuff. I think if whatever you do, it should arise from a loving place. And because there is no need for fear when we know that we are immortal souls, you know, that this lifetime is just a page in a very big book. So let your protesting, let your actions, let your work, let your mission, let it arise from a love of humanity and a love of service and a love of contributing. And you know, because that is who we are at our core. When it comes from fear, I think it has a very limited and a different impact on the collective.
Well, I just want to put my energies into those things that I know will make a difference. And one of them is into these programs, these podcasts, in the conversations that I have with people like you and you, into the work that I do that I know is going to make a difference, big or small. And I'm not concerned about how big or small it is, as long as I'm doing something. It's really funny, too. When I start talking, I get these images in my mind when I'm talking For example, speaking of putting in energies towards those things that are going to help. I don't know about where you live, but where I live in the rural part of California, above on a mountain top above Santa Barbara. And of course, we have wildlife all over the place, deer, and we've had bears, and apparently there's been reports of bobcats, and we get snakes, and we get this and that and the other. But one of the things that happens is that sometimes, you know, you'll get an infestation of maybe insects, maybe ants. And of course, we've learned to be able to read the signs, so to speak. It's not a question of reading an anthill per se, but when the ants start coming out and so forth, and that's a sign that the weather's about to change.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a problem, of course, with rodents, and they have gotten up into the attic. Well, here in the States, a lot of homes are built with what they call gable vents at each end of the roof to allow the heat to escape. Well, unless there is a mesh that is placed over that vent, still allowing the heat to escape, you can get the rodents climbing up trees, jumping onto the roof and into those vents, and now you've got an infestation of rodents.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the gable vent that we have near some trees has not been covered, and of course we have an infestation of rodents in our attic. Finally, the other day, putting my energies towards something that I know will help, we finally put a mesh over that gable vent. And the population has been diminishing. Mm-hmm. And so you get rodents, you get certain bugs and so forth infesting your house. It can get very unhealthy. It's not a good thing, you know? So I put my energies towards that, and it was a very simple process. Didn't take a lot of energy to do, and it was done.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, I think, a key, that it doesn't take a lot of energy to make a big change.
Yeah. I think you're spot on there, Richard. There are ways that's essentially what excuse the shameless plug, but that's very much what Bring Him Home is about. You know, it's like, it's a little book, you know, it's not a massive, well, you know, books aren't, yeah, it's just a book, but the more it goes out there and spreads the word of the sacred masculine and what conscious relationships are about, and about the union of the masculine and feminine, and you know, and coming together, then you know that's it has the potential to make a big difference from just, you know, from one little book, because it can be replicated and read by you know, lots of different people. So you're absolutely right, you know, but you can't, it's wise man who looks at, yeah, where do I put my energy, you know, what are the things that can make a significant difference. And you know, and as I say, as long as it's done with love and it's done from a pure place, then it will benefit, it will make a difference, make a difference.
And a lot of times it only takes, maybe it takes some time in meditation. Maybe it takes some time in prayer, whatever that is for the individual. Maybe it takes some time in a creative mode. Maybe you paint, or you write, or you draw, or you sculpt, or whatever it is that is creative for you, or just sitting out. I mean, I could take a lawn chair and set it out off the side of the house and just gaze off into the wilderness and just feel nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's like there are so many. Rumi says, you know, Rumi, the Sufi mystic poet, says that, you know, there are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. And, you know, and I think that's it. We all have different gifts. We all have different ways of contributing. There are people, who they can just stay in their house and just pray. You know, or meditate, or send out loving energy, then that's, you know, that's as valuable as somebody who's protesting or at the front line of something, or who's the CEO of a company that's doing things differently. You can't measure this stuff, can you? There are so many different ways of contributing and making a difference. And I think that is what is, gradually happening. People are realizing that small things consistently done result in big changes.
Yeah. And that's not to say that if you listening are compelled, you just feel drawn to protest. No judgment here. Go for it. Do what you feel you're led to do. I mean, we're not here to say what is right or what is wrong. That's for you to decide as far as what's fulfilling for you. I think, though, that Miguel, you might feel the same way about this, that when we start going within and we start getting in touch with the real us, the real person inside, that immortal part of us, that we're going to get the guidance necessary that is going to be beneficial to us as well as to the rest of the world, or the community that we're in, or the family that we're in, or the business that we're in, and so forth. So again, we're not here to say whether or not protesting is right or wrong. These are our own personal observations, and we certainly hope that you'll keep that in context. Bring Him Home, a twin flame love story. I want to dive into this a little bit. I was actually reading a portion from one of the excerpts as well. I think it was from chapter 2, and it reminded me of a story that I wrote 25 years ago. Now, it was a rather erotic story, not necessarily pornographic, but erotic. It was a love story. It's a gentleman, he's going to take a plane. He's at the airport, and he meets this gal in the airport, and they kind of connect, and they're talking and so forth, and both of their flights are delayed. So they decide to get a motel room and so forth. Very loving, very mutually consensual, passionate, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what that made me think of near the end of chapter 2 in terms of this love story. But it also reminded me, as I mentioned earlier, about the concept of the split aparts, as was mentioned in the movie The Butcher's Wife. Mm-hmm. The phrase soulmates is thrown around a lot. Is that a concept for those who didn't hear our first interview back in July, or August rather? What are your feelings about that phrase, that word, that title?
Yeah, I guess my response really is I don't know. I don't know. I think, you know, there's all sorts of the soulmates, split aparts, twin flames. I mean, the book, you know, in the title is The Twin Flame. And I'm very clear in that my understanding of twin flame is just what I know through my own personal experience. So, and it seems to fit, you know, the general idea of what twin flames is. Soulmate, I haven't really got a clue. Richard, because my sense is it's something that's, you know, that's kind of soft, companion-y, kind of like, you know, really coming home sort of feeling. And it almost feels to me as if soulmate is kind of like something that you come to after you've been through the twin flame journey. But, you know, I'm not sure about this whole thing of, you know, one soul being split into two and having to find your other in amongst the other 7.5 billion people. I think that there are many potential twin flames and partners, that people that we can come together with, who will, through the commitment to love and union, that we will also become the best version of ourselves, because we bring up old wounds and bring up everything that is not love arises to the surface through the union of the relationship. So yeah, soulmates, the jury's out for me on that one.
Okay, let me ask you about the story of Bringing Him Home. Now, the story in this book regarding the the twin flames, as we are talking about now, the twin flame love story. This is, I kind of want to touch on this because I think it's important. this is a love story. There's obviously there are a lot of meanings and metaphors in here, but the story itself is, if I may categorize it, and I apologize for categorizing it, it's a heterosexual story, right?
Yes.
Okay.
On one level, yeah.
Okay, good. Because I'm going to have you elaborate on one level, because yes, it's a heterosexual story. However, that isn't the relevant part of the story. It's about two individuals, regardless of the outward gender manifestation, mm-hmm. finding each other, coming together mm-hmm. in a loving relationship.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the first level, if you like. It's called Bring Him Home, because my understanding and my experience of conscious relationships is that they will bring you home to yourself. It's not like about coming home because I'm completed by being with this woman. It's the coming home to oneself. So, and it's called Bring Him Home because my partner heard this command when she was meditating. She would say, you know, what's going on with this relationship? And she said that every time she asked that question, she always got the response, bring him home. And she didn't know what that meant. But I knew very much, you know, I knew very well what that meant. It was about coming home to myself and how she was helping me heal the mother wound that I'd been carrying, that had been keeping me away from the divine union within myself. So that gives you a little bit more to go on, Richard.
And you know, that's rather interesting, because again, it goes to that aspect of going within to find oneself, to know oneself. And I've often phrased it this way, that the levels of knowing start with self, then one's creator or whatever construct you believe in, mm-hmm. and then others. So there's three levels there. But if you don't do if you don't get in touch with the first level, you know, it's very difficult to get in touch with the second or third levels and really live them in a fulfilling way. I mean, I remember when my first wife said to me when we finally finished the divorce and I was off on my journey, she says, "Well, you," and it's a little attitude on this. She says, "You do realize that whatever problems you have, you're taking with you into the next relationship." It's like, I kind of knew that, but I also had plans on working on those "quote unquote" problems, or as a therapist, I was recommended to go see in the 10th year of my 15-year marriage. Said to me that I had character flaws, and I thought, okay, not the kind of words you want to hear from your therapist, you know. I know I'm screwed up, but that's my business. You know, I don't need any help from you. But it is true. We carry these things and people run around. A great line from a song I love says, you can travel on 10,000 miles and still stay where you are. Mm-hmm. And so I made it a very real point to work on those areas of my life that I felt were maybe a little out of whack or a little askew or weren't fulfilling, weren't satisfying, and so forth. And that's really what you're encouraging through this. What about your own personal story? Now, Bring Him Home is not, it's not a memoir, it's not an autobiography, but I'm sure that it has got to parallel your personal experiences to some level, because obviously as the writer, your own stuff is going to come out whether you like it or not sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, Bring Him Home is kind of a memoir. Ah. I mean, it covers sort of 18 months. It's a true story of what happened. But I mean, it's connected. It's kind of like a little snippet, you know, of my whole story that arrived, that meant that I arrived in that place where I met this woman, and, you know, and the the voices said, bring him home. He's ready to come home now. He would just need the final push. So, you know, and that was all connected to the fact that I'd lost my mother as a baby and that my stepmother had been angry and abusive and violent. And so so I'd had no real experience apart from the first 7 months of what love was. So I was in search of that which I tasted as a little baby, you know, for the rest of my life. But there was this big wound that I was terrified to open my heart to woman and to really fall in love, because it had been such a painful experience as a child, losing my mother and losing the, you know, the embodiment of the divine feminine. So yeah, there's a big connection between my own story, yeah, that, you know, that brought me to this place of bringing him home, which, yeah, it's a totally true story. It's it's exactly what happened. And, you know, I wanted to share it because I wanted to share, to bust open the Hollywood movie myth of what romantic relationships are about and so on, that, you know, the truth of relationships is that they can be uncomfortable, and they are there to help us become the best version of ourselves and ultimately to bring us home to divine union within ourselves.
It's very interesting to set down into something tangible like a book. The truths about ourselves. Was there ever any trepidation on your part about talking about some of these very personal things to the general public?
I wrote my first book about 8 years ago. It was published, Stepping Stones in the Mist, and that was kind of like a, you know, a bit of a autobiography about the, you know, the early times of my journey. And I shared that, you know, there was trepidation then, but what I found was the feedback was people were saying, I could so relate to your story, and I saw there was so much healing in me being vulnerable and authentic. And that really became central to my whole way of being, that I realized that vulnerability is a superpower, and that when we just share all of ourselves, warts and all, everybody else breathes a collective sigh of relief and goes, oh, thank goodness for that. It's not just me. Because, and of course, the return for me is I don't have to hide anything. If I can just put it all out there, this is who I am, and I'm not ashamed of any of it. It's, yeah, I've messed up and I've done what I can to, you know, to do better. Then it means that there's a massive weight off my shoulders and I can just relax into this being the fullness of my flaws and my beauty and the miracle of who I am and, you know, the dark and shadow and everything. Because we're all living different versions of the same story, you know?
You know, that's one thing that has occurred to me. It's like we all have all of the same emotions. We all experience them.
Yeah.
In spite of the fact that, as you mentioned, the 7+ billion people on the planet, all those 7 billion stories are all different. And yet, because of the fact that we all experience the same emotions, they are all the same, basically. It's not like my story is, let me see if we can top each other's story here. That's that's not the goal here. Who's got the best, worst story? They're all different. And in some cases, when you share yours, it can be, especially considering, let's say it was something to be overcome, and you do overcome it, it can be of inspiration to someone, even if it's just one person who got something from it, learned something from it, and is able to move forward. I guess that's sort of the frustration when you hear your parents tell you that they're trying to protect you so that you don't make the mistakes they made. And yeah, that's great, but at the same time, don't we have to learn? So a lot of times, don't we have to learn from our own mistakes?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like in a maths test or something where it's like, show the workings out.
Ah, yeah.
It's like, you know, that's what my book is. It's showing the workings out. It's showing all the messy bit that, you know, and the other stuff in the middle that the Hollywood movies, you know, miss out.
Yeah. I like the messy bits. That's kind of, I like that phrase, the messy bits.
Yeah. And it, you know, when it came back from the publisher with the editor's initial comments, he said, this is a really unusual book. He said, I've never come across a book quite like this. He said, because books come in the sort of like growth and personal development area, they're nearly always, the majority of them is about telling people how to do stuff differently and how to heal and so on. Mm. He said the other part is about showing. He said, now your book is 99% showing and there's hardly any telling, and that is really unusual. But that, you know, just what you were alluding to, Richard, that, yeah, through showing people and sharing your story, for me, that's the most powerful way of, because then people take the bits that they want and apply it, and they, you know, they juggle it around in their minds and change it and adapt it to their own situations, and they have all these little light bulb moments. That's the feedback that I'm getting from people that have read the book. Mm.
Well, you know, over the last few years, the more recent years, I sometimes sit maybe out at the beach at the end of the wharf, or maybe sitting up at the house looking out the window at the trees and what have you, and I start musing about certain experiences that I've had. And there's a part of me that thinks, you know, you should be writing this down, even though it would be a short story. Hold on to it. Start putting down these short stories, and eventually you'll have yourself a nice book, you know, along the same lines. But I think that what you are describing is a perspective from which a book like that would be so appropriate. You know, not telling, but actually sharing the story itself and the experiences that I had, rather than trying to necessarily be profound, if you will, or insightful. You just put it down and see what happens. And that sounds to me like what you've done is you just put it down and you let it be. You weren't trying to do anything other than share your story.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's quite honest.
Yeah. Thank you, Richard. Yeah, it's, and again, that's another one of the traits of the sacred masculine, is just to be honest and truthful and just authentic and real and transparent. We put so much energy into hiding bits and concealing things that society has told us are inappropriate, or, you know, that are private or that are taboo. And I just, I want to bust those taboos, you know. Let's talk about everything, you know. Nothing's to be not spoken about. When it's not spoken about, it grows into a monster in the dark, like, you know what I mean?
Oh, my gosh. Two things on that. Number one is back when I was working for the Christian radio station and kind of being educated to a certain level about God, the thought occurred to me of the three aspects of God that are omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, to what you just said about the sharing the story, the messy bits. There are over 7 billion people on this planet. God already, the divine, whatever concept, already knows all of this about my life, about your life. Mm-hmm. What difference does it make if 7+ billion people know, and besides, most of them, the majority of them, don't care? They're too busy just trying to survive. They don't care about what Richard went through yesterday or last month or 10 years or 15 years or whatever years ago it was. They don't care about that, or what Miguel Dean went through 40 years ago, 30 years ago, what have you. Mm-hmm. So what difference does it make? Plus the fact, talk to us about the freedom, the release, if you will, that you felt, the lightness that you felt following the release of this book.
Yeah, it's very liberating. As I alluded to, it's just I don't have any secrets. You know, I don't really believe in secrets. I believe that, you know, if we could read each other's thoughts, and I think that maybe we did, maybe there was a time when we were telepathic and so on, that, you know, that lies and dishonesty only sort of probably originated from, you know, when we started using language. Because, you know, I think it just takes a few people to start being honest and open and taking the masks off, and other people going, oh, right, look, he's still okay, and people still love him, and people, you know, you kind of like win quite a lot of respect and so on, because people say, wow, that must be, you know, you must be you're really brave to do that. And it doesn't really feel brave to me. It just feels, it's back to that thing of what feels in alignment to truth, you know. It's like, well, that, it feels good and it feels okay. And yeah, and I know that in the early days there was an element of, there was some external validation, you know, through sharing sharing all my story, and people going, oh, wow, you know, aren't you brave? And wow, you know, look where you've traveled from and so on. There's a bit of that in there, and I'm happy to hold my hand up to that. But there's also, you know, there's so much healing for other people, and that brings a freedom, you know, to you in itself. That must be in alignment with God, if you like, because if it's a win for me and it's a win for them, then how can it be wrong? You know, let's do it.
Mm-hmm. I've also noticed, too, and going back to what we started with on the program, the political end, I've noticed in the United States, not so much in the UK or other countries, when politicians get caught in something, whatever it is, an indiscretion of any kind.
Yeah.
The ones who come out and deny it, cause it to, and they are far and few between, come out and say, I raise my hand, I admit, I'm guilty, I did it, I am sorry, I'm ashamed, I've brought shame on my family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, please forgive me. It goes away. You don't hear, because it's kind of like you go into an argument with somebody and you are just, you've got your argument all laid out, you've practiced it, and now you're going to go lay into this person, and you first start out saying, I've got to talk to you about that. No, you're absolutely right. And you just take the wind out of their sails. Well, that's what you do when you tell the truth, when you acknowledge you acknowledge the existence of, and again, I love the phrase, so I'm going to use it, the messy bits in your life. When you acknowledge them, as you said, there's no monster that grows in the middle of the night, in the dark.
Yeah. We've all got messy bits, you know. That's what it is to be human, and this is, comes back to the whole union of the masculine and feminine as well, you know, the embracing of the shadow and the light within us, you know, the mistakes that we've made, and the urges to, you know, not do the right thing or do something that's selfish or whatever. That is part of this humanness that we are. It's okay. It's only in the, as you said, it's in the denying of it that it creates a problem. You know, it becomes a big thing. And if you look at, I mean, that's the whole taboo around sex, and that people don't talk about sex and stuff. Look at the darkness that has created in the industry of pornography and the child abuse and the rest of it, which was why in Bring Him Home, I chose to write in detail about the bedroom scenes, and because I wanted to portray the beauty and the sacredness that sexual union can be.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk about all of it, you know. Sex is seen as a messy thing. Oh, we don't talk about sex. It's like, well, why not? It's one of the most, for me, it's perhaps the most awesome aspect of being in a human body. Like, you know, it's just awesome. You know, the creator was just having a really good day when he thought that one up, you know?
Absolutely. And then there's one more aspect to that. How in the hell do you think the 7.9 billion people got here in the first place? I mean, come on. That's it. Actually, there's a great deal of humor in that. And it is very extraordinary. As a matter of fact, and I'm going to share this. I was having a relation at the age of 21. I was having a relationship with a woman who was 32 years old. She was a divorcee. the typical, you know, what is it? The typical Mrs. Robinson kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I remember coming home one morning after spending the night at her house. And my mother came into the bedroom and she says, you know, the kids are asking where you are. You know, what are you going to tell them? To which I said to my mom, I said, I'll tell them the truth, you know, and so forth. And she didn't have a problem with that. She just wanted to know what I was going to say. Miguel Dean, I want to thank you so much for giving us so much time here on the program, sharing your story and the incredible work that you have been doing, especially through the books. This most latest work, Bring Him Home, A Twin Flame Love Story. And I encourage people to get in touch with you through your website, migueldean.net. And we, again, thank you for giving us so much time. And I love talking with you. It's wonderful. Sort of kindred spirits, you know, across the pond, as they say. Although, if we were to go to the west instead of to the east, it's a hell of a pond if we go over the Pacific and then across that landmass to the UK. I noticed that we go that direction rather than the other. But thank you so much for talking with us today. And I hope to have you back again in 2020 to discuss more of the work that you're doing. And maybe in a future program, maybe what we can do is we can discuss some of the specifics, maybe the protocols or the structure or the steps that maybe you go through in some of these gatherings with both men and women, and talk about some of the your observations of how the dynamics within the men's gatherings and the women's, as well as the dynamics of both men and women, are changing for the better, or maybe not so much for the better. Maybe we can talk about that in our next program.
Yeah. I'd like that. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me back on the show again, Richard. Yeah, it just flows really nice. I agree totally. It just feels we always have a really good conversation. And my prayer is that, you know, a little of what we've shared will have been of benefit to some of the listeners. So thank you to everybody listening as well.
Before we let you go, of course, the same invitation as before. Should you find yourself here in California on the Central Coast, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. And, of course, I want to ask you before we let you go three final questions. A reminder to our listeners, though, go to the podcasts on the homepage of richarddugan.com to listen to this and other interviews as well as going to migueldean.net to find out more about the work that he is doing, as well as to get a copy of Bring Him Home, A Twin Flame Love Story. And I'm going to ask you these three questions again, because some time has passed and maybe the answers have changed. And if they haven't, that's fine too. You may have actually addressed them during the interview, but I do like to ask them directly. And the first one is, who is Miguel Dean?
Miguel Dean is a human being and all sorts of other things that is constantly evolving and becoming each day a better, more beautiful, more loving, more authentic version of him or itself. Because, yeah, let's not assume it's just a person. There's maybe more than that. How's that?
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I would like to, to contribute to birthing a new earth where the children are born from a loving, conscious parents. And so, you know, given a really beautiful, solid start to life, so they don't have to go through all the wounds and healing that myself and many of our generation went through. So, yeah, it's all about creating a more beautiful world for the children.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Yeah, my life's purpose is to return home to oneness while still in this human body, and to be able to share that journey and the insights and the processes and the things that have helped me with others to help them on their journey back to peace and love and oneness and unity.
And I will work with you together on that. I'm very excited about pursuing that oneness aspect. Miguel Dean, again, thank you so much for joining us. And I thank you for listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.